My subject this morning is how to benefit from changes in your life. It's an important subject because change is a part of life and it's something that we can't avoid, and yet it's something that we constantly try to avoid. The very nature of the universe, although God is stable and unmoving and at the center of everything, the nature of the universe, because it's the way it was made, it was set up this way, is change. In other words, the universe rests on the principle of movement, of vibration. And if it weren't for that movement, everything would dissolve back into the spirit. You can think of a tuning fork, that when the tines move in opposite directions from a state of rest in the center, then they set up the vibration that creates sound. But wherever there's sound, there's also light. When God said in the Bible, "Let there be light," what he was doing was sending out a vibration that produced light. Before that, there was the lightless light, you might say. It was a higher potential than light. It wasn't darkness, but it was that higher potential where light wasn't needed, where there was just an absolute perfection, absolute stillness, absolute bliss, absolute love, and an undifferentiated consciousness. Now, if we think of it in another way, we'll perhaps understand it more clearly. An ocean. When you have a wind passing over the surface of the ocean, let's say that first of all there isn't any movement at all, then the ocean is like glass. But as soon as there's wind passing over it, the waves begin to appear. And those waves are necessarily compensated for by troughs in the surface of the ocean. If it weren't for the troughs, you couldn't have waves, because you can't change the level of the ocean by trying to raise a part of it. The ocean level average remains always the same. Similarly, our lives are constantly fluctuating. That fluctuation is a part of manifested creation. It's a part of what makes us human. It's a part of what makes it possible for us to exist in human bodies and to relate to this world. And secondly, the changes that take place in this life are always going to fluctuate between opposites, just like the surface of the ocean going up and down. Similarly, all things in creation have their polar opposites. They're balanced out by those polar opposites. And without those polar opposites, they couldn't exist. Everything would merge back into the one state, which is spirit. And those opposites are like light and darkness and pleasure and pain and love and hatred and cold and heat and so on. And some of these changes, some of these polar opposites, we ourselves would not take necessarily as positive or negative, but many of them we do. Many of them we respond to in saying that I want this and I don't want that. I want pleasure, I don't want pain. I want love, I don't want hatred. So we think. And yet, in truth, each one of these is intricately, inextricably, a part of the other. You can't have one without the other. The oppositional states of this life are like hate and love. They're, as long as that love is expressed outwardly, it's not all that different from hate. It's merely a slightly different manifestation. The only way to have a kind of love that grows and that has no opposite is for it to be an inner one, a love that is felt at your center rather than imposed upon something or someone outside yourself. The same thing with pleasure. If you can take pleasure inside and feel the joy of your soul, there isn't an opposite to that kind of joy. But as long as the joy is outward, then it will always be fluctuating. You can't change that fact, because it's the way that this whole universe can exist in the first place. Now, what this means is that if we can learn from the changes in our lives to remain at rest in our center and not be affected by them, this will be the greatest benefit of all. If we can learn from change to reach the changeless state, then we will have learned the supreme lesson of change. But there are other lessons to be learned in the meantime, because what we're living in is sort of a labyrinth where we have to thread our way past all sorts of delusions, misunderstandings, and so on. And if we could learn how to benefit from the lessons that life gives us, whether through tragedy or through fulfillment, whether through joy or sorrow, all of these experiences of life have certain things that they can teach us. If we can learn how to thread our way through those to even human wisdom, that human wisdom ultimately will bring us to the point where we see the same truth. In the final analysis, still, the real lesson to be learned is to be at rest within ourselves. The conditions of this world, as Yogananda put it, are always neutral. There isn't anything that's positive or negative in itself, that is to say, that's good or bad in itself. There will be light and darkness, yes. We can call those positive and negative, but if we use those words, positive and negative, to refer to whether they're good or bad for us, then we have to say that there isn't anything in this world that is in itself either good or bad. It depends on how you take it. I can look back over my life and see the tragedies, the difficulties, and I have to say that I gained a great deal more from many of those, perhaps from all of them, than I did from many of the joyful experiences. Then which was good for me? Surely that which taught me, and therefore maybe I wouldn't say court sorrow, because then you wouldn't be learning your lesson. If you suffer under sorrow, you're not learning. But if you can take sorrow and not be sorrowful. I was singing some of these songs that you heard earlier, songs of divine joy, I've called them. And when I wrote them first, I was singing them in many different places. And sometimes people would say, well, you can afford to sing such happy songs, you haven't suffered. My answer to that was, it's because I've suffered and learned the lesson of it that I have a right to sing these songs. People who just get up there and sing in a sentimentally sort of slushy way, you don't feel it. But when there is conquest, when you have gone through it and learned to come out on top and realize that in spite of it, you can and you shall be joyful, then you not only have a right to sing, but people feel that right. People know that the people feel something from it that is powerful to them. Now, we want to benefit from change in this way. The first and most important thing to remember in this world is that you can't live without change. It's not possible because life is change. The only way to cease changing is to die. And of course, that's another kind of change. But in this world, if you have a body that's dead, at least it can't move itself. And indeed, people who try, for example, to fix their religious beliefs in form of dogma have to kill those beliefs to dogmatize them. People who have to fix their understanding of life and want to keep it in just this way and not allow anything to move, they have to kill themselves in some way. They get like something that Jyotish told me years ago, that they made a survey of people in... He was working in the welfare department, and they went to a lot of poor apartments and so on. And they asked many of the women that they talked to what their happiest moment was in their lives. And an amazing and sort of pathetic majority or pathetically high number of them answered their happiest moment was the high school prom. Here they are in their 40s and 50s still looking back to that high school prom when he gave me an orchid. And living in the past, living in some little fixed moment, living in some fixed idea of what it should be all about and why did it have to change. And indeed, it will change day after day. It's going to change in many ways. But the second thing after we understand that life is change is to recognize that it's not always going to be a change for what we would call the better. And yet, we can make it for the better if we understand correctly and, as I say, thread our way through this labyrinth to the exit. It won't be for the better if you take it in the short term. You'll invest money in the stock market, and then you'll lose money in the stock market. And I think of all the excitement and the feeling that I've finally broken through. I read about somebody who won $150,000 at Reno in the slot machines or something, and I couldn't help, first of all, thinking how much had she lost in order to win that 150, but the second thing was, how much would she lose again having won it once? Thinking that now I've got it made and I'll be able to keep on. Very few people stop while they're ahead. But the truth of it is that it's always going to fluctuate. You'll have sunshine, you'll have rain. And if it were otherwise, you'd die of boredom. People don't want it always to be the same. They tell themselves they do. They weep because it isn't. And yet just imagine a life where nothing ever went wrong. Just imagine a novel about a boy who was born on the right side of the tracks with lots of money and constantly chomping on that silver spoon. And he grows up and he gets a job in some rich company and he marries the boss's daughter and he has 50 glowing children and a lovely swimming pool and everything goes right. Just imagine, where would you put the book down? Probably page 10. It would be boring. But if he's born on the wrong side and has to go through all these struggles and ups and downs and he's finally made it, then you think, oh, doesn't that feel good? But you go to a movie, you go to a play, you go to see Hamlet, and you see, gosh, Hamlet, everybody practically is dead at the end of it all. And this is the only one left practically is the fellow who's got to be there to say goodnight, sweet prince. And you come out of that and you feel so wonderful. I learned so much. There's such a cleansing in my heart. Why do you feel good from such a disaster? Basically because you're not attached. Basically because it didn't happen to you. What we've got to do is have that degree of detachment from our own lives that will enable us to say what a good movie that was. What a good show. I love the story of Ananda Mohima when she was sitting at a place about 300 miles away from their headquarters in Benares. And it was around midnight, and suddenly she started laughing and laughing, and they said, "What is it, Mother?" And she said, "Oh, that headquarters of yours has just gone into the Ganges." She wouldn't even identify the organization as hers, although it was all built in her name. And the next morning a telegram came saying that the main building of the headquarters had been washed away in a flood. And the architects were all, they were devotees of hers, and they were all sort of weeping about the tragic loss. And see, she just joyfully said, "Don't you have any compassion? That poor building was standing all those years. It got tired. Give it a chance to rest." But this kind of non-attachment was a wonderful lesson to them. I don't know if they took it or not, but it's the lesson that awaits us all. If we would learn to first adapt to change, first accept that life is change, that there's there's nothing else that you can expect of life than change. They say death and taxes are the only certainties. Change is just as certain. And the second thing is that those changes are not always going to be in a single direction. There's no way that they can be in a single direction because they've got to constantly fluctuate back and forth from that single center of reality. And the center of it all, at the center of everything, is that core of reality. And everything will be a movement away from that reality, but always coming back to it. And so, like a pendulum swinging, it will pass that middle point and go on. What happens with people is that as they realize that on this side is pleasure, on that side is pain, it's like a swing. They want to go further this side, so they pull the rope to go further that way. And, of course, it's inevitable then that they swing farther in the other way. People who are trying to get away from the negative side, people who try to get away from change, in either of these two ways. One, by going toward pleasure and thinking that now I'm going toward the positive and accentuating the positive and everything's going to be just great. They cannot escape the opposite. It's just not possible. It's the law of life, and you can't change that law. And the second thing, those people who try to make to keep anything from changing, all they do is make it brittle, so that when the change takes place, it's greater. They say that about the San Andreas Fault, that in a way it's almost worse that it hasn't moved. Now they say, well, there have been little movements, and that may be doing it. But anyway, the principle is there, that if for many, many years you don't have an earthquake in an area where the ground is gradually moving in opposite directions, if you look at the San Andreas Fault from the air, you can see places where it's moved by a long distance on one side of the fault from the other, because the earth is moving in opposite directions at that place. And if for a long time the crust of the earth doesn't move and you don't get an earthquake, that means that the tensions are just building up to the point where when it does take place, it'll be that much worse. So it is in our lives, that if we think to avoid both kinds of change and just try to make everything absolutely fixed and firm, then when the changes come, we have become brittle and they're likely to break us. We see many broken lives because of that, because they're so attached to the status quo, so attached to what it is that they have fixed around themselves in the way of possessions, in the way of experiences, in the way of habits, and so on. When we can learn that change is life, when we can learn to grow with change, it would be good even to convince yourself to enjoy change. It would be good to say that it would be good to disrupt your life periodically just in order to remain flexible. Shift your furniture around, move somewhere, do something different. It's something that Americans are good at, and it's a virtue. It can become too much of a good thing if it leads toward just wanting change all the time. And some Americans have that kind of consciousness too. But basically the ability to go with change, to be attached to it to some extent, can be helpful. More than that, however, we must realize that we never change inside, that there is a core of reality within ourselves that remains constant. If you can learn from change to realize that this is you, that the world moves around you, but you don't move, then you will be able to be always at home wherever you go. Most people's reality, unfortunately, is outside themselves. They become addicted to a thing, to a place, even to change itself. There isn't a great gain if your addiction is to change and you think to beat the system by going with the change, because always you will find that if your center is not here, you become drained, and you become drained of your ability to relate meaningfully to whatever goes on in your life. We must then understand who we really are. Try to get centered in yourself. Try to become, through your meditations, through non-attachment, try to reach the point where whatever changes take place, you see that it's all basically just patterns of light and shade going on in your life. This world is a dream. There isn't anything real about it. It seems real because it's consistent. You go to sleep at night and you have a different dream every night. You wake up in the morning and you wake up to the same dream. And so for a few years it seems consistent, but when you leave this body, suddenly you see it wasn't the way it looked. Everything that you have is not really yours. Everything that you are isn't really you, except your own inner nature. There's something unreal about it that makes it that three people seeing the same thing will see different things in it and report it as if it were something totally different. We see it through the veil of our own understanding. The apparent reality of this world is altogether different from what it seems. The chair that you're sitting on isn't solid, it's really energy. The body that you have seems to be so fixed, and yet it's only a holding pattern of energy where you take food into your body through eating, through inhaling, and through the sunlight, the energy that you get in the sunlight and so on, and that those things that you take into the body through some control system go out to form nails and hair and eyes and flesh and so on. A very interesting thing that I heard recently was that they've discovered that if there has to be in childhood, let's say, a skin graft from the abdominal area onto the arm, maybe because the arm has been very badly burned, and later in life you start to put on weight in the stomach area, the part where the skin is on the arm that came from the abdomen will put on weight too. It's those cells have been programmed to be stomach cells, and they don't know that they're on your arm now and aren't supposed to behave that way. Very peculiar. But here these cells go, and they're the same food particles are programmed to go out and behave in certain ways for a while, and then they get sloughed off and others come in, but the body changes to a vast extent constantly through your life. And yet the body remains essentially the same body. It's a holding pattern of energy. It isn't your body at all. It's what's staying there for a while before it moves on and something else comes in to take its place. It's like an organization which continues even though the entire personnel of the organization may change. The organization then isn't the people. It may not be the buildings. It's some sort of abstract entity. You are an abstract entity, if you can handle that one. And what you must realize is that your reality is something altogether different from this which seems to be relating to other things and other people and enjoying the feeling of ice cream and the lovely cool feeling of the water when you swim it and the warmth of the sun when you bathe in it and so on. All of these things are really only dreams. They aren't what they appear to be. This world is a very different reality from that which it seems when we get hooked on a particular body and its particular expressions. It's a part of the lesson of life to teach us to withdraw mentally from this in order to become centered in the reality of it, to become centered in who we really are. You don't really own anybody. You don't really own anything. And the pains and so on that go on in this world are, they too are really just dreams. The pleasures and the pains both. The lesson of life is to understand that we are, it isn't just a negative thing that we aren't this. It isn't just sort of an abstraction that we are something altogether different. We can't figure out what. It's something very much more real than these things. And this is perhaps the most important lesson to learn on in this whole process of change. It's not a lesson that most people can learn easily. It's a lesson that you can learn when you have faith in God, above all. When you have faith in Him, not just belief in Him, that is to say, when you seek God. What I have seen is this, that the most disastrous seeming changes all are beneficial. That God's will, you see, you get a fixed idea in your mind that this is how things ought to be. And when things are a little bit different, you suffer. And you think, oh, why did she leave me? Why did this happen? Why did I lose that? And it's only after many years that you finally realize that it was the best thing that ever happened to you. But at the time, you think it had to be this way, and so you can't change. If you could get into the flow of life, and it's much more so if you can get into the flow of higher life, which is superconscious life. That's why I speak of God. On that level, it's incredibly clear how the things that happen, if you really accept them as coming from God, if you really accept them as His will and give them to Him, that which seemed the worst turns out to be the only possible solution. I've seen it happen again and again, that something would come to me that I would think, oh dear, what a terrible thing. And then I'd say, no, you know what you're doing to God, not to myself. And God, you know what you're doing, and I accept that what you're doing is is right, even though it seems totally the contrary of what I would think. And once I've accepted it, suddenly I see that things work out in such a way that it was very clear that that was the only way it could happen, or happen for the best. And yet what happens is that if you remain brittle, if you, in your mind, don't accept that it's God's will, don't accept that it's something good, then it's sort of, to offer an example, like a person clutching at a straw. And there he is drowning, clutching at a straw. Well, the straw isn't going to save his life. And a boat comes by and sees that this person is so fanatically addicted to that straw that he can't even see that there's a boat there. He's just hanging on to that straw. And so he takes the straw away to change the person's focus so that he can see that there's a boat that he can grab onto, and he won't reach up his hands to be saved. And so he takes the straw away. This is the position that people are in their lives again and again and again, where they feel that their straw has been taken away from them, and they just sit there floundering. They flounder and kick about and weep and wail that they have lost their chance for happiness or salvation or whatever it might be, and they don't see that the boat was right there. All these things, said Francis Thompson in that wonderful poem, The Hound of Heaven, all these things I did take from thee, not for thy harms, but that thou mightst seek them in my arms. And this is the truth of it, that God takes things from us in order that we might understand on a higher level. What is the meaning of tragedy? Aristotle put it beautifully many years ago when he said that the reason people go to tragedies, the reason people enjoy the tragedies on the stage, is that they effect in you a kind of catharsis, a cleansing. A wonderful example of that is the play by John Millington Synge, Riders to the Sea. It's a great play. If you haven't read it, it's just one act and very short. But it's the final scene in the drama of a woman's life in the Aran Islands of Ireland. And her husband and all her other sons have been taken by the sea at one time or another in their lives as fishermen. And this one son goes out to, I forget now, it's been a while since I read it, but he goes out to the sea, perhaps to save the other son. They bring him back, and he too, the last one, is drowned. And the end of the play is this woman praying before God and realizing that everything I had has been taken from me. And what's very wonderful about the way the play ends is that she says, and I am at peace now. I have nothing left to cling to. I'm just myself. This is the whole real lesson of tragedy, that all the things that you're hanging on to are taken away, and finally you realize that you have yourself and the night and infinity. You see, God takes things from us not to punish us, but to release us for a larger vision, to help us to realize that we are everything, we are everywhere. In that complete relaxation where you no longer hang on to something and you give it up, if you can give it up voluntarily, then suddenly you have that feeling of being in touch with everything. But the trouble is that people don't do it voluntarily. And so the boat passes them by, and they have neither the straw nor the boat. They don't do it voluntarily, and so the very opportunity that was given to them is broken. It's like a little baby. He has a toy, and it's broken, and it won't work, and he's all unhappy, and you take that toy away to give him a good toy that works. Well, he wanted that other toy, and so he throws them both on the ground and breaks them. This is how people are in their experience of life, that instead of taking whatever comes to them, they suffer. Even after years, they're still suffering and saying, why did this have to happen? Why? I loved that person so much. Why did she have to leave me? Or all that kind of thing that goes on again and again in this world. If they could only understand that it's our reactions that make these things seem good or bad, And if we could learn not to react at all, but only to allow these experiences to feed our inner wisdom, it isn't as if we'd become automatons, incapable of feeling. It's that it all, good, bad, indifferent, everything would augment the inner feeling that would give us constantly more joy. So that even when things seem to go wrong, you think, oh, how wonderful, let's see how wrong they can go. And you find a delicious freedom in that. It just, nothing seems to matter anymore. When you react, then even the littlest thing can seem like a mountain instead of the molehill that it really is. I was wondering, when I first went to Rome, and many people came to me for interviews, and it was quite a strain because I didn't speak Italian at that time. I knew a few words, and I sort of lumbered along in French and Spanish and English and whatever Italian words I could throw in there that might make the grade. And anyway, these people would come and for 15 minutes pour out their life's tragedy. And I had these from early in the morning. I couldn't even get into the shower without the phone bringing me out of it until late at night. And all of these things were so tragic. And the amazing thing to me was that they were, many of them, really tragic. Like some woman who had been married by her parents against her will to a very rich boy who was just wrong in the head. And just this marriage of money for family's sake that made her life an absolute tragedy. These things do happen, but when you hear them every 15 minutes, and I used to think that Puccini was really exaggerating, but when I got to Rome, I realized he was just telling it how it was. And so I realized that what was wrong, this was one time we went up to Florence, and this one lady came down to breakfast in the morning, and I said, "How did you sleep?" "I didn't sleep well. I don't know why I didn't sleep well, but I didn't sleep well. Why don't people sleep well when they don't sleep well?" And I wasn't really quite prepared for a tragedy before my coffee, but there it was. You make a huge thing out of nothing, and then you get yourself into a mindset where you're generating a kind of magnetism that attracts huge things from you. It's as if you're saying that life is full of huge things, and so life says, "Well, gee, if you want huge things, okay, here they are." And so what you expect from life is what you get. And indeed, I've seen tragedies there that I've never seen anywhere else. But if you could learn that conditions are neutral, that whatever takes place in this world, let it be, it will go on anyway. You can't make this world perfect, you can make yourself perfect. You can make yourself perfect in the way that you respond to things. Try to find something positive to say about or to find in anything that occurs to you. Or at least don't be ruffled. Don't let it get your goat. As soon as you start to, you see, it's an interesting law that Jesus expressed when he said, and it doesn't seem fair at all until you understand it, "To those who have, more shall be given. And to those who have not shall be taken away even that which they have." Seems like a terribly unfair law, until you realize that what he's talking about is magnetism. That when you've generated a particular kind of magnetism, you attract to yourself more and more and more of that, or set into motion a certain kind of habit, and you develop more and more of that particular habit. You set into motion the opposite kind, and you have less and less. There's failure magnetism as well as success magnetism. People who live in the thought of poverty will always have poverty. That's why I've thought that it's very bad karma for a person to beg. Because what it does is constantly say that I don't have anything and please help me out. And that constant emphasis in your mind, "I don't have anything," will generate a kind of magnetism where you won't have anything at all. Whatever kind of magnetism you put out, that's what you will begin to attract. So, if the changes of this life get to you, and you react in a negative way to them, and I even shouldn't even say react in a negative way, because reacting in a positive way ends up being the same thing, that two being so inextricably tied together, But when you allow yourself to react outwardly instead of remaining calm and at peace within yourself, you can react. I used to see Yogananda react, but it wasn't an outward kind of reaction. It was always something that fed his inner consciousness. I looked into his eyes and I saw that they were just untouched. And yet here he was seeming to be all enthusiastic, but his enthusiasm was for something different. It was for the joy within and the wonderful ways that that divine joy could find to manifest itself in the world. You see, it doesn't reduce you to being an automaton. It's an altogether untrue impression that people form of spiritual consciousness, that you become incapable of relating to this world in a human way. Masters are human, but they're human in a divine sense rather than in an animalistic sense. The typical attitude of Jesus would be somebody who had absolutely no sense of humor, was incapable of playing games on people, and giving anybody a hot foot. Can you imagine Jesus giving anybody a hot foot? Unthinkable. And yet, Yogananda one time, and I told the story in the path, one time he saw Dr. Lewis lying in bed snoring away, and Dr. Lewis saw him. I got this one wrong, didn't I? Anyway, Yogananda used to play tricks too. There was one time where the children in the school were all meditating in a row, and I guess he could see that they weren't meditating deeply, as he felt playful. So anyway, they were sitting there meditating, quotes, and suddenly one of them felt something hit him from behind, a little something or other, and somebody else felt it. And finally they realized that Master was there with a little blowgun blowing paper pellets at them. It's similar to the hot foot idea, and there's no reason why Jesus shouldn't have been that way too. All the masters that I've known have a playful side. All the masters that I've known have a delightful sense of humor. They're human, and they're wonderful to be with. And it's not as if you had to think to yourself that I mustn't react, and therefore if somebody cracks a joke, I just sort of, how about that? Look at Humphrey Bogart, and you get the typical American attitude of how you should be if you want to be above it all. Sort of talking out of the side of your voice, and here these poor mortals are all just suffering and dying like flies, and, well, it's a hard life. Masters can weep for you. They weep. Jesus wept for Jerusalem because he saw how again and again God had tried to save the Jews, and they had just turned away and wanted to live with law and not with grace. And again and again you find their ability to feel people as they are, but they don't react in a personal way. It's sort of like with little children. You see that a little child has broken its toy, and you certainly would not be a very feelingful adult if you say, oh, listen, it's all a dream anyway, don't worry. Quit your belly aching. You don't talk like that to children because you know that they couldn't understand. And you say, oh, there, poor dear, it's too bad, but come on, I'll get you a nicer one. And so you react in a real way that the child can relate to and feel good about and finally come out of its particular slump. Well, that's what the masters try to do with us. Indeed, they could be completely above it and just not be touched by anything. Sort of like a story of Ramakrishna, that one time he cut his arm somewhere and he was crying with the pain of it. And the disciples were dressing it, and there was a very rich patron who was about to enter the room, and the disciples tried to keep this person out. They didn't want this rich person to think that their master was so such a slave to physical sensations that he would cry because of them. But Ramakrishna was just being natural. I mean, if he wanted to allow the feeling of it to enter his mind, he'd feel the pain. But there was another time when he was dancing in ecstasy, and he fell against a brazier. full of red hot coals. And the disciples were all right, have your laugh. What time is it getting to be anyway? And one of these coals got embedded in his back. And he didn't notice it at all. And one of the disciples smelled something and looked and saw this coal and said, Master, Master, there's a coal burning in your back. And he said, oh, is that... Just take it out. It doesn't matter. But he was... You see, they allow themselves to come down to a human level, but they're not touched by it. And they could indeed reach... They could easily just go into that state. Like that time that Yogananda had a 1,000-pound wishing well that they were setting in place drop on his foot. And the pain, it swelled up immediately, and the pain was very great. And he said, look, I'll show you the difference. If I keep my mind down to the body level, you could see that it took willpower to control his features. He said, now I'll put my mind here. Suddenly, his face was at peace. He didn't feel anything. You can try this. I've noticed this in the dentist's office. It's been sort of an interesting experience for me. I always figure, first of all, that a little pain never hurt anyone. And I don't like to take Novocaine, so I try to practice mental control. And it's very easy. What you do is simply sit there and do Hong So or compose music or think about something else, and there the dentist's drilling away and your mind's on something else, but you're not thinking about it. Or if you find that it's too bad, then think about it completely. And so by just being completely focused on the pain, you find that then suddenly it just disappears. It's like looking at a wall. Have you ever tried that? You look at patterns, wallpaper on a wall, and you stare at it long enough, and suddenly you don't see it anymore. Some feature of the way the eye is made blanks it all out. Well, the same thing with concentrating on pain itself. If you can't withdraw your consciousness from it, then concentrate on it, and pretty soon it stops being real. I had this experience two nights ago. We had the Holy Land slideshow, and I put so much of myself into it and so much work, and I just pushed myself to the point of exhaustion, and I believe it's a wonderful thing, but I must admit that looking at it that night, after having worked so hard to get it together again and improve it, I was looking at it thinking, how can anybody like this stuff? Staring at it long enough and it sort of vanishes and you can't really quite relate to it. Oh yes, that is music, isn't it? Kind of feeling. Well, you might try that also with some of the experiences you have in life. That, you see, change is a wonderful lesson because it keeps you on your toes. It keeps you learning. It keeps you looking out. It keeps you trying to understand what it's all about. And so you look at these things and they begin to seem not all that important. They're different from you. They're apart from you. You are always here. And you see that by absorbing yourself in them for a while, then suddenly what probably happens is that your concentration reaches a certain point where it becomes focused more here. And then the things of this world, the differences and fluctuations, don't seem to really exist anymore. These are all keys, for how to make pain, how to turn change into a plus in your life. Be non-attached. Don't feel that anything that you have is yours. It would help you every day to, when you go to bed at night, give it all back to God. Everything that you are, everything that you have, everybody that you know, everything that you've done. Mentally, if you could construct a fire and think of all these things that you are attached to and just throw them into the fire and watch them burn. And don't allow yourself to say, oh dear, it's burning. Say, yes, take it away. I don't need it. It's not mine. Take it like this. And until you reach the point where you really feel at night when you go to bed, God, it's yours. It's not mine. Someday you're going to have to pass that greatest test of all, death. That's the final and greatest change. It's one that even the masters are a little nervous about before they finally get their minds concentrated on the inner reality. And I noticed Yogananda in the last year or so of his life was very much in that sort of mental frame of just throwing it all out. because he knew that he was leaving, and therefore he didn't want to be identified with anything. It was very much that sense of this isn't my world. He was very abstract a lot of the time, very withdrawn, very... he was more in a sort of wisdom bhav. We think of him as warm and loving and sort of motherly, and he was that too, but in the last year or so of his life, you didn't see much of that. You just saw this very inward consciousness. But we must have some of that all the time. One sadhu in India told me that a sadhu must live ready to go to the Himalayas in a day. So that if God should call you from whatever you have to do to go to the Himalayas and seek Him, you could leave it at a moment's notice and never look back. We must have this kind of thought. Maybe preparing for this talk today, I had a strange dream the other night where I dreamed that I left everything and went off to another country and was living in some very poor apartment and feeling perfectly happy, and Jyotish and a group came over and pleaded with me to come back. But we have to constantly tell ourselves that nothing that we are, nothing that we have is really ours. And I feel that way about everything that I have and everything that I've done, that it's not mine. Ananda has been started. I don't allow myself to think, yes, I did it. If God should look down and say, who did that mess? And I say, oh, I know. Give him not only the credit, but also the blame, if you will, for the things that you do wrong. He likes that, Yogananda said. He likes for us to make him responsible for everything, so that if you make a mistake, then don't say, well, I made the mistake. Say a mistake happened, he did it. It's not as if you were blaming him. It's rather that you're freeing yourself from the hypnosis of error so that it will be easier for you to change the next time. You want to accept change in this way. Well, look at it like this, that a man who has committed a murder dies, and in his next life he carries with him the karma of the murder. He has to learn that lesson, but he doesn't have the hypnosis, I'm a murderer. And thus he's given a chance to climb out of that pit rather than sink himself deeper and deeper into it. This is a very important thing that God gives us. People say, why do we have to forget? There is a certain level where we don't forget. And that's why these karmic lessons are good for us, even if we don't really know where they come from. But not to have the thought that I am that which I did is a very necessary help toward climbing out, as I say, of the pit. What you've done in this life, just say, well, it happened, but I can start. As Sri Yukteswar said, forget the past. The past lives of all men are dark with many shames. But everything in future will improve if you make the right spiritual effort now. And thus it is that we must live in that thought that every moment is the beginning of our life. That every moment is our chance to start building anew, our chance to make the best of any further opportunities that come to us. And remember, another thing is, first of all, that if things are going well, they won't stay well, they won't last in that way, and don't become too attached to that. But also, if things go badly, they can't continue to go badly. There will come a point where they will turn around and start to get well. A further and interesting thought on that is that if, or rather perhaps I should say, the sooner that you can really accept whatever comes to you in a positive and relaxed way, the sooner they will turn around and become better. It's as if with that attitude you suddenly draw goodness out of what looks like disaster and despair. I've noticed this again and again, that things start to close in on me, and I allow my mind to get negative about them and worry, and what should we do about this and what should we do about that? And then I meditate and I feel God's joy, and I realize, God, you're doing it all. It's your problem, your show. And so I just joyfully relax about it. And it's as if God himself just smiled and said, ah, now you've learned. And so he takes the whole thing away and everything becomes beautiful again. It's like that test that Yogananda was giving a woman who was very sort of too egotistical, too proud. And every time he saw her, he scolded her. And very often, unfairly. In fact, he made it a point of it, scolding her for bad reasons as well as good reasons. And she got very upset and burst into tears every time. And why is he so unfair? And he knows I'm not like this. And he doesn't talk to others who are like that. And why does he talk to me and all this? Finally, she decided that, well, it was happening. She might as well accept it. And maybe there was a good reason for it. And whatever it was, she became calm. And he was in the midst of a tirade when he saw that she was just quietly taking it and not reacting at all. And he stopped in the midst of this tirade and smiled. And he said, "Ah, you're learning." He said, "I was trying to make you more docile." And he never scolded her again, at least not in that way and not for those reasons. So it is that I've seen that God very often seems to be dishing out some hard lesson. But the moment that a person relaxes and says, "Oh, God, this is fine, whatever you want, I feel good about it." And the moment you do that, suddenly everything turns, and what looked like a disaster threatening suddenly became a blessing. That in fact, it's sort of like the story that I had when I first got that harmonium. It was a harmonium that I'd wanted for several years. And I discovered, because in those days they didn't import harmoniums, we didn't know how to do it. It was a very different scene then. We didn't know whom to write to get harmoniums or anything. It was a much bigger project than it is today. And I found an Indian in Hollywood who owned a harmonium who wanted to sell it. And so I bought this harmonium and I was so thrilled. It was $25, which doesn't seem like much money now, but it was a lot then, and it's a lot for somebody whose allowance is $15 a month, which mine was. And I was so thrilled to get this thing that we were working at India Center then, at the Hollywood Church, and every 15 minutes I'd stop working and go into the library and play another chant, and it was a desire, a real desire fulfilled. And I came back to Mount Washington and saw Master getting into the elevator to go upstairs. And I said, "Master, Master, look what I've got." And he looked at it and said, "Oh, how wonderful, I'm buying it." Well, what he really meant was he was buying it for me. But he didn't say that. And I thought, naturally, that he wanted to buy it from me. And I said, "Oh, no, sir, I'll give it to you. I'm giving it to you." And so he said, "Well, I'll take it for a little bit. I'll take it upstairs." So he played it. Then he wanted to give it back to me. All he really wanted to do was buy it for me, so that I didn't have to spend a month and two-thirds allowance to get it. And secondly, bless it by playing it for me so that I would always know that my guru had played it. But because of all the noise I made in my own mind of renunciation, I didn't get the point at all. And for 2 days, it was like having lost a wife or something. I I wanted him to have it. I didn't want it. It's not as if I was grieving over that. It was that I was wrestling with this attachment of my own. And I didn't for a moment want to accept it back. Then he tried to give it back to me, and I wouldn't take it. I'd gone through this thing once, and I wasn't going to go through it again. So he said, "Well, I will buy you another one then." And he bought me one that cost $40. But anyway, and he played that, and I still have the joy of his having given me a harmonium. But you see how with the noise that I made, I prevented a sweet thing from happening, and if he hadn't been even sweeter, it wouldn't have happened at all. But this is how life is with us, and this is how God is, that it looks as if he's taking away our heart's greatest love. It looks as if he's taking away our life's greatest happiness. It looks as if he's shattering us with some terrible deprivation or tragedy even. And those people who make a tragedy out of it, those people who get all upset and weep their hearts out about it, they miss the opportunity that life was trying to give them, which was positive. Basically, positive in two ways. One is that there isn't anything that's only negative or positive. You can draw the opposite out of it so that in the worst experience, there's some good that is attached to it, which you can rescue if you'll open your mind to it. And the second thing is that God, if you live for him, God really does answer your prayers. This is something people find hard to believe because they've never tried it. But if you live and don't pray to him in such ways as, God, why don't you come to me, and so on, negative ways that push him away. But just try practicing the consciousness of living with him, of making him your partner, of doing things consciously and joyfully in partnership with him. You will be amazed to see how he does answer, how the littlest things he will give you if you wanted them, how there is a certain pattern that comes into your life, and there are lessons that he sends you that you may learn, where there is a certain amount of randomness in the ordinary life because they're just reaping the fruits of their karma. When you are working in attunement with him, you will find that you're being directed in ways that are always meaningful. The more you live in him, the more meaningful, and the more constantly meaningful the various experiences that come to you are. So accept change. You've all had hard changes in your lives. And I suppose those are the ones that you need to address yourself to more consciously. It's not that hard to accept a good change. And yet, if you can't accept good changes, so-called good changes, in the same spirit, you won't have the power to accept the bad changes in that spirit. In other words, when you send in a little coupon that promises you $1 million or a trip to the Riviera or whatever it might be, and you actually win, what is the average reaction? You've seen people on TV winning because they answer a few questions right, and they in fact make it a point naturally to get those people who are most likely to respond in a sort of a jumpy way. And so you see them with this wonderful acquisition of a trip to Hawaii or a new house or a new car, and like this, and they're all excited. But those same people, because they allowed themselves to react so emotionally to what they call a good experience, will naturally weep their hearts out when that house that they earned burns down. That was a lovely thing here in Ananda, how when we had that fire, people were able joyfully to go out and start again. Neighbors that we have lost their homes and are still sort of suffering under the shock and burden of it all. To gain the power to be able to take tragedy, disappointment, bereavement, any kind of disaster in your life, to take it calmly, to gain that power to be able to react calmly to whatever comes, you must have the power and practice it in the good things as well as the bad. Whatever comes of itself, let it come. Take it inside instead of gripping it outwardly in the fervor of your enthusiasm. Take it inside and say, well, God, that's very nice. Sort of like in Autobiography of a Yogi, you read how Master's father had been given a very large bonus because he hadn't collected his due fees for overtime work and special projects and so on. And he deposited this huge amount of money in the bank and never even thought to mention it to his family. And sometime later, one of Yogananda's brothers saw this in a bank statement and asked his father about it. And his father replied that one who is pursuing the path of even-mindedness is neither elated by gain nor depressed by loss. This is the attitude that we must have always through life, that we're not elated nor depressed, but always cheerful. It isn't as if you become numb. It isn't as though you become callous or apathetic. It's that you always remain at your center. And when things go well, that's nice, but you don't go overboard about them. Worldly people will say, well, gee, don't you like it? You may like it much more because you know your capacity for enjoyment is intensified when your heart becomes bigger. It's intensified when you can feel it here rather than out there. Worldly people lose, bit by bit, the ability to enjoy anything at all. Such that in late years, many people are just sort of walking cadavers, really. Jesus said, let the dead bury their dead. But those people who have an inner ability to just remain peaceful and happy all the time, even-minded and cheerful is the motto of the yogi, they're able to enjoy very deeply, even if they aren't smiling. I met one saint who didn't smile in the time that I knew him at all, and yet I could feel in his presence a great joy. They have this quality inside that doesn't require an outward expression. That's what you really want, and whether you express it outwardly or not is trivial. But that joy that never changes is the goal of wise living. When you can reach that, then you have God, because God is always that reality that never changes, that is at the center, that calm center of everything. In your meditation, get to that center of yourself, and then when you come out into the world, live always in that center. As soon as you come out of it, you find yourself drained. You see, the experiences of this world can feed you, but if instead you are feeding them, if instead you're going out to them, if instead you're thinking that this person is somebody I need, I want to be with, I want to relate to, and so on, if it's all that way, you find yourself after a period of time being absolutely emptied of your inner strength and your inner joy. Take it inside. Whatever you experience, enjoy it quietly here. You'll see that the more you do so, the more life will become one long experience of joy. It never changes, because it's not a joy that is in this oppositional state from positive to negative and so on. It's a joy that is the joy of the Spirit. In that kind of joy, you can laugh loudly, but it has a different quality to it. Remember, it's not a matter of outward behavior so much as inward consciousness. In the Bible, Jesus says, two shall be working in the field, one shall be taken and the other left. What he means is that the outward work that you do, the outward ambience that you're in, the outward appearance, these things you can't tell quickly from one person to another. And yet one is going to hell and the other is going to heaven. That is to say, one is dooming himself to a life of misery, and the other is gradually climbing out and going toward a state of inner joy. It's a question of consciousness, not of how you behave. It's not something you put on to impress other people. But between you and God, you will see that this is always so, that the more you live in your heart, the more He gives you an unchanging joy. So, you can benefit from change. You can benefit by being unattached. You can benefit by accepting that that change will go on. You can benefit by realizing that none of those changes that take place really affect you, that you are at a core of silence within yourself where nothing that happens is really, it's not you. It's just a part of the dream. Whether it's good or bad or indifferent, just take it as another reminder that that's not you. And then take it inside to draw whatever energy it has to give you. And when you give energy back to it, give it from your inner self and not from attachment, not from being bound by it. In that way, then, you will begin to see another thing. And I've touched on it briefly here this morning already. This is true more, again, for devotees than for people to whom life seems a totally random picture. But the more you call on God, the more He enters consciously into a relationship with you, and the more things begin to happen that are meaningful. If you will, I remember a practice that I have followed in my life at various times and found very helpful. That after meditation, instead of just leaping out of meditation into work, I do a kind of moving meditation which helps to create to deepen the practice of keeping the meditative state even while being more active in work. If I were to go straight from meditation to the intense activity of work, it would be too easy to leave the one for the other. What I need is a bridge that will help me to practice consciously with concentration the meditative state while acting, which is to say to act only to the extent that I can still feel that meditative state. So what I've done is take a very slow walk, not hiking, just sort of slowly, very slowly ambling along and feeling that while moving, I'm moving in God. And then I concentrate on my body and I feel God moving through my body. I concentrate on the energy of behind my muscles and I feel that it's His energy that I'm using. Then I think of my thoughts And I feel that every thought that I'm having, I'm sharing with God, so that I feel not just that I'm looking at that green leaf, but God, we are looking at that green leaf. Or God, isn't that grass beautiful? And then I find that in that conscious moving meditation, where I use the senses but in a meditative way, I begin to feel that God is in that grass too. And that if I hear a dog barking in the distance, that God is barking through that dog. That if a car is moving, I feel, well, God is moving through that car, and the sound that he's making is a sound that it's divine, not just the sound of a motor. And you can call this a sentiment, and of course it is, but it leads to something that's a lot more. I begin to feel that here he and I are sharing thoughts and inspirations in a way, and I'm hearing him in that, and it begins to seem as if he's saying things to me through the dog. It isn't as if he's really saying it, but I'm asking him, what are you saying to me through that dog? It's a way mentally of reaching out and feeling a part of what's happening, feeling a part of that dog barking and a part of that car moving and a part of the leaf in the tree trembling in the breeze. And in that thought, this is what Yogananda said yogis should try to do, is to feel that they are in all of this. And the more you enter consciously into that, the more you begin to feel that what's happening is in some way really related to you. Well, the positive fruit of this in one's own life is that, as I said, you generate a magnetism of a particular kind, and you draw back to you according to that magnetism. So you put out this magnetism of expectation in thinking that all of this is a part of you, all of this has meaning and relates to you, and you begin to find in amazing ways that indeed things start happening in your life that do relate to you, that have meaning, that have a direction, that teach you lessons that you need to know. That I remember a case a few years ago of some lady who came to talk to me. She wanted an interview, and she was sort of a foolish person, and my instinctive reaction was to sort of try to finish it up quickly, because there was just nothing I could say to her and nothing she could say to me, and out of politeness listen for a bit, but I had other people I had to see. And I thought, that's not wise. The moment I stop thinking that God has something to say to me is the time that he's most likely to speak, just to teach me a lesson. And so I said, all right, let me listen. She had some thoughts she wanted to share for our community and things that would be helpful. And I thought, what can she possibly know? She's never been able to succeed at trying anything like that herself. And so I said, no, put that thought aside. Maybe God has something to say through her. I should listen. And I found that indeed she gave me good advice. I haven't been able to follow the advice, but it's good advice. The things that if you really are listening, then God will be more likely to teach you than if you stop listening. An intriguing story that a lady told me in India years ago was that she took initiation from Swami Shivananda. He told her to get up at 4 o'clock every morning. And at 4 o'clock every morning, from then on, she would hear the wooden chappals, the wooden sandals that sadhus sometimes use, walking along the porch to her door and knocking on the door. And she'd get up and open the door. There would be nobody there. But it would get her up and she'd meditate. And she went on like this for some months. But then family things came along and it sort of became inconvenient to get up so early. And so she stopped getting up at 4. And for a few days the footsteps continued. But after a while they stopped coming. Because she stopped listening, he stopped coming. If you don't listen to God, then don't complain that he doesn't talk. Why should he waste his breath? But if you do listen, you'll be amazed at how through change, through all the ups and downs of life and the various things that can come to, that seem even to be determined to destroy you, how if you can really sit back and accept it and say, all right, what have you got to teach me? First, I accept. It's a fact. I might as well accept it anyway. But I do accept it with my heart. It's like that woman who grandiosely said, I accept the universe. And somebody said, by God, she'd better. But the truth of it is that very few people accept even a small part of the universe. They're always wishing it were something else. Learn to accept. Just say, all right, I accept it. This is what is. How do I relate to it? And the second thing is, ask God, what are you trying to teach me through this? And don't ask him in a negative way, why did you send this to me? Have you got something to teach me? But in a complaining or arguing way, just say, God, I love you, and I know you want my best. And even if you want to destroy this body and everything that I've done, God, I love you. But just let me understand, that's all. Because that would be the greatest blessing of all, if not only you treat me as you choose, but I also understand why you treat me this way. And so with love and acceptance, you just say, show me. You'll be amazed how clear those lessons are. You'll be amazed to see how there isn't a single change that has ever happened to you that is really bad for you. There isn't a change that could happen to you that is bad if you take it in this spirit. It will be from God if you take it from God. And God can give you himself if you take whatever he gives you in the right spirit. Change is pain, but only as long as we're attached. It becomes joyful once we become non-attached. I have noticed in traveling around the world that there, most people will look German or French or Italian or English or American. I remember sitting in a restaurant in New York with a friend many years ago before I came on the path, and I turned to this friend of mine and said to him, that lady who walked in the door is English. And he said, that's ridiculous. You can't tell what a person is just by looking at them. And she just at that moment stopped by our table and spoke to her escort with a very broad English accent. And it's so, you could see from, I've noticed this with an example is Texans. They talk in a certain way, and they have to hold their lips a little like this, sort of a thin line at the edges that makes it look as if they were always smiling. But they've got to hold their lips that way in order to talk that way. I see Lewis here smiling away. And it affects the way you hold your mouth, particularly the expression in the eyes. But there's more to it than that. You pick up wherever it is that you've been, and you adapt their mannerisms and adapt their way of thinking and so on. But I've seen a few people everywhere who don't look as if they belonged to any particular place because they're at home wherever they go. They don't merely reflect their environment. They become a cause rather than an effect. They're always centered in themselves. Wherever they are, they're at home. And so they can be in different countries and express their ways and express their mannerisms. And so they become like reflections of wherever they go, but they're always just centered right here. This is how we really want to be. That whatever happens, don't let it affect you to the point that I've always sort of resented a little bit going into a shopping center and hearing the music with a particular rhythm and finding the hypnotic effect, the impulse to walk in rhythm with that music. And I always have something against being made by anyone else to act in a certain way in automatically, and so I make a deliberate effort not to walk that rhythm. I don't know if this is a wholesome reaction in itself, but I think that to not allow other people to dictate the way you think and feel, not to think differently on principle, because that's slavery too, but just whatever they say and however they feel, take it inside and think it over, and then if you decide that, yes, you'll do it this way because it's right, you do it from inside yourself, and you may go along with the crowd, but you've done it because that's how you felt, rather than because they felt this way, or rather than not do it just because they felt this way. In either case, you'd just be the subject to reaction. Be centered, be non-attached, live in the moment, not for the moment, but in the moment. Not attached to the moment, but always know that wherever you are, that's where your home is. Carry your ashram with you wherever you go, and you'll always be in God.